Morning, August Fáiltis Deoch. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life.
Good afternoon and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the first Black, Brown and Green Voices program for the academic year 2022-2023. Gosh, I can't believe I'm mentioning 2023 already. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'm honoured to be with you today to share in a conversation with a remarkable person, Dame Elizabeth Anion Mu. Today is Indigenous Peoples Day in the United States and World Mental Health Day, and I can't think of a better way to spend a day of reflection like this than with Dame Anianwu, who I will refer to as Elizabeth during the interview. She has quite kindly given me that permission. Before I hand over to my NYU colleague and African American Irish Diaspora Network colleague, Professor Kim DaCosta, to introduce our guest speaker, I'd like to thank the team at Duxman Ireland House NYU and my colleagues at the African American Irish Diaspora Network for their support in mounting this programme. If you'd like some information on either institution, it's in the chat function there for you. I'd also like to thank our promotional partners, NYU's John Braidmus Centre, especially Tom McIntyre and Polly Terzian, and at New York Public Library, Schomburg Centre for Research in Black Culture, especially to Sonia Richards and Joy Bivens for their support with these programmes also. This probably won't be the first time I will say this, but I want to start off by saying what a pleasure it is to read Dreams from My Mother, and I highly recommend it. I hope that we have ample time to talk in depth with Elizabeth about this wonderful memoir. Now let me hand over to my wonderful colleague and friend, Professor Kim DaCosta, with whom I've collaborated on some of these activities at NYU and through the African American Irish Diaspora Network. Over to you, Kim.
Thank you so much, Miriam. Well, I have the pleasure of introducing Dame Anianwu, who was born in Birmingham in 1947 and identifies herself as of Irish Nigerian heritage and started to work for Britain's NHS as a school nurse's assistant at the age of 16. In 1979, she helped to establish in Brent the first nurse-led UK sickle and thalassemia screening and counseling center. In 1988, she was awarded a PhD from University College London. And from 1990 to 1997, she worked at the Institute of Child Health, UCL, as a lecturer, then senior lecturer in community genetic counseling. She's written extensively and is a co-author with Professor Carl Atkin of The Politics of Sickle Cell and Thalassemia. She was honored with a damehood in the 2017 Queen's New Year's Honours List for her services to nursing and the Mary Seacole Statue of Peel. In 2004, she was presented with the Royal College of Nursing Fellowship for her work in the development of nurse-led sickle cell and thalassemia counseling services and education and leadership in transcultural nursing. She is a patron of the Sickle Cell Society, the Nigerian Nurses Charitable Association, and the Sickle and Thalassemia Association of Nurses, Midwives, and Associated Professionals. And she's chaired several projects for the NHS Sickle and Cell Thalassemia Screening Program. Her memoir, Dreams from My Mother, was recently reissued, and we hope you can get it soon in the UK, in the US in print, but certainly we look forward to the discussion today.
Thank you so much, Kim. Great to have you here, and thank you for that lovely introduction. Elizabeth, again, welcome. Such a pleasure. And I should say that it is Black History Month in Ireland as well this month, as well as in the UK. So it's a really nice timing for us to be speaking to you as part of the programming. But could we start off a little bit on 1947, the context of how this wonderful confluence of Irish and Nigerian heritage in the UK comes together, and tell us a little bit about your origin story, if you don't mind.
Thank you very much indeed. And I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm so excited to be communicating, conversing with you all across the pond, so to speak, via Zoom. I am now 75 years of age. And I was born, as you've alluded to, in 1947. And I was the outcome of an affair between my parents whilst they were both students at Cambridge University in England. My mother was in her second year studying classics. And my mother is the Irish parentage. And my father was Nigerian, and he was literally completing his law degree at the same university. I never knew my father. I had my mother's maiden name, Furlong, good old Irish surname. And maybe if I talk about my mother's Irish heritage.
That would be great. I was going to ask you that. That would be great.
Fine. So my mother's family was Furlong. And when I was researching for my memoirs, I found this wonderful Dublin genealogist who was able to help me go right back to 1840 in respect of my grandparents' Irish history. Both my maternal grandparents were born in Liverpool, England, in 1896. Their parents were emigrants from Ireland to Liverpool. It looked around about 1870s. The families are, some of the names are Furlong and Kehoe. My grandfather's family came from County Wexford. And my grandmother's, this is my maternal grandmother, came from County Down. It's the Wexford family history that I know more about. And there was one interesting, very interesting discovery for me from a letter that I received from my cousin who had received it from our mutual great aunt, Aunt Kate. And she had set out a little bit more of the family history for us. One of my, I would be a great grandparent, was John Furlong in Wexford. And he was a hedgerow school teacher. Now, I had not actually heard about this, but I soon did find out that this was during the time when it was illegal for Catholic children in Ireland to be taught to go to the local schools. This ancestor of mine, who was the school hedgemaster, he was teaching the children illegally in the hedgerows in the countryside. And if he got caught, he could have been jailed, could have been deported to Australia, might even have been killed. So it was very, very courageous thing for somebody to do. So I was quite proud when I read about that, actually. So that's the Irish ancestry. I don't know whether you want me to say any more about that or...
Maybe what I'd love to get a sense of, if it was okay, how Irish was the sensibility of your mother? And my understanding is that you go to live with your grandparents for a protracted period of time, and that kind of brings you, ironically, in a way, closer to some of that heritage in a way. Can you tell us a little bit about
certainly.
That?
Talk about my mother first. And by the way, it would have been my mother's birthday today.
Oh, wow.
She was born in the same year as the late Queen Elizabeth II.
Wow.
And so my mother would be 96 if she was still alive. She would.
Wow.
So I think that I thought I would mention that to you today.
That's amazing.
Because it is through my mother's heritage is where the Irish ancestry is. When I talk about my mother's experience of becoming pregnant while she's at university, not married, so the stigma, because my grandparents were very loving, my maternal grandparents were extremely loving, very devout Catholics, and so my mother couldn't bring herself to tell them that she was pregnant. She was so ashamed. And also, my mother was the first one to go to university in the family and to go to Cambridge University. I mean, I could just imagine, you know, the rejoicing that would have been. So it was when she went home, the vacation period, and my grandmother said, because my mother was apparently 6 months pregnant by now. And my grandmother said, "Are you pregnant?" And my mother said, "Yes. When were you going to tell us?" And my mother said she wasn't. She was going to go to the local river and jump in and drown, because she couldn't bring herself to disclose this pregnancy, where she knew not only her dreams would come crashing down, but so would her parents. And they had been very loving towards her, very helpful. So I often say one thing, though. My mother's experience was not like Philomena's experience. We know the very famous story of Philomena now. It was a book and then a film. And it was actually the Catholic Church rallied round my mother's family. Maybe because they saw that this was a clever girl. She was at, you know, a prestigious university. These were a devout Catholic family. My grandfather was a friend of the local parish priest, you know, so I think all of that helped for my mother not to be condemned. In fact, they bent over backwards, as we say, to try and organize for my care so that my mother would continue her studies. But my mother refused to continue her studies because she didn't feel she could have the career she wanted to in those days and keep me, because she was just adamant she was not going to give me up for adoption. And I always thank my mother for that.
And all of that is in the context of her not disclosing who your father was, correct?
Quite right, Miriam. Absolutely right. So there was an assumption that a white baby would be born. And that there was an assumption, I think, that it was a student, a white student at the Cambridge University. So come the day that I was born, a few days afterwards, I was in a Catholic maternity hospital in Birmingham, England, run by nuns. And apparently my grandparents came to see me, and the nun stopped them from coming into the room where my mother and I were to alert them. And this was the way she did it, because it's gone down in our oral history as this. To be sure, the baby's a little dark. And that was just to warn them, this was not a white baby you're going to see. And there was I, apparently, brown-skinned, with a big afro, even as a baby. So there was no disguising. And as you mentioned, my mother had not spoken about my father to anybody. She certainly hadn't told them that he was Nigerian. So the first knowledge they had was when they looked down in the crib, well, and saw me. And my mother refused to say anything about my father for some time. I think she must have been in such a frightened, shocked situation. But you are asking me about my contact with Irish culture. And one of the reasons it was from childhood was I spent my first 9 years in a Catholic children's home run by nuns. Mostly pleasant experiences. There were some unpleasant experiences due to my skin colour, but overall, it was pleasant. And one of the reasons I thoroughly enjoyed my time there was that I was taught to play the piano by one nun, and I was selected with a small group of children to do Irish dancing. And I have the most incredible memories. I mean, you know, there's the song Brown Girl in the Ring.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that was me. I was the brown girl in the ring. And it attracted a lot of attention because we would go on little dancing tours in the West Midlands where the children's home were. And I got a lot of applause for my dancing. I loved it. I really. And I remember, though, often I would get money pressed into my hands by the adults that were there. And then the nuns would take the money off me and I never saw it again. So I got a bit cross about that, having said that. So that was the biggest influence in terms of my Irish heritage as a toddler up to the age of 9.
And was that positive? Was it a positive?
That was positive, yes, because I was taught Irish tunes on the piano. And I did the Irish dancing, and I did a lot of Irish dancing, and I was it's a bit of a show-off because, you know, we would get dressed in our lovely Irish dancing costume and our buckle shoes. I did I have a sense of rhythm from both sides? I have no idea. But I could do a reel, I could do a solo. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And to this day, I really enjoy watching Irish dancing. So that was my first introduction. Then I went to live with my mother and my stepfather, but only for 20 months. That was a more traumatic experience, not because of my mother. She was wonderful. But she didn't realise that my stepfather, who was white, was being teased by his friends in the pub where they went to drink. What was he doing, allowing his woman to have a half-caste child in the house? I don't know whether this is a term, you know, this is a term that we don't really hear now.
Yeah.
But it was a very common term. We're talking about the 1950s England now, just to put it in historical context. And I was my stepfather, when my mother wasn't around and when he'd had a tipple, used to physically abuse me. And it got so bad that my mother discovered it and called upon her parents, my maternal grandparents, now living in the northwest of England, to help. And they rescued me. So from the age of just, I think I was 10 and a half, I went up to the northwest of England to stay with my maternal grandparents. Now, I just love my grandparents, and particularly my grandfather. I had a very close relationship with him. And he would tell me stories about Irish politics, because we had a lot of records in the house, my grandparents' house. And one of them was the wearing of the green. And I was humming this song, and I used to go for walks with my grandfather. He told me, he was a lovely storyteller. And he said, I heard you playing that tune, that record. He said, do you know what it's about? Somebody wearing green. He said, the Irish were denied the opportunity to wear shamrock. It was illegal. So this was a rebel song. He was the one that taught me about rebel songs. I didn't know anything about it. He was a civil servant, upright, standing, you know, but he knew his Irish history. Mm-hmm. And I think he was very pleased that I was able to enjoy.
And you were interested.
Yes, yes. And so that's really where, and then with my grandmother, Irish cooking, soda bread and all of that. So I had my second tranche of Irish cultural experience living with my grandparents up till the age of 16. So looking back, I think I was very fortunate that I had this injection of, by the way, going back to my grandparents' house, that's where I listened to John McCormack. They had all his records. And I remember this LP that was there, and it had this gorgeous photo of John McCormack with his beautiful eyes and smile looking out at you. So that's where I got introduced to a lot of Irish folk songs, which I now have on my phone. So when I'm walking, I'm still listening to some of this.
Yeah.
So I hope that gives you an idea of where the influences came from for me.
Would you mind if I asked you, Elizabeth, when you grandparents kind of rescued you, as you say it, were they welcoming and how were they with you at this point? You're 9 and a half, 10. Were they more comfortable with you as this mixed race grandchild? How was that dynamic for them as you saw them navigate it, or was it apparent to you?
Wasn't really apparent in terms of my grandfather. He was just a very loving grandfather. I mean, I was a little bit scared of him, as I think he was very tall. He used to wear his hat and he smoked, but he was never cross with me. But I think, to remember, I never really had a decent father figure. So I was a bit scared of men. Not surprising with what had happened with my stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
And in the convent when I was small with nuns, the priests were occasional visitors and they were treated like gods. You know, we were never allowed to go near the priest. You know what I mean? So my grandfather was the first wonderful man that I met that I can relate to. And my grandmother was very homely and motherly to me. But interestingly, I was very attached to two of my grandfather's sisters, so my great aunts. They lived in Liverpool and they would have me for holidays every so often. They were very, very religious, both of them. And one day I was out walking with one of them in Liverpool, and a neighbour stopped her to greet her. And my great aunt introduced me as an adopted child. And I thought, it's interesting. And it made me realise that they were loving, but they couldn't bring themselves to declare that actually I was a relative of theirs. So that made me realise, it's not straightforward at all. There is stigma attached to my skin colour. And nobody ever spoke about my father. Ever. Ever. You know? I mean, I wrote to my mother when I was 25, to ask her about my dad. And that's when she wrote back and told me, gave me all his details. So I grew up not knowing who my father figure was, my natural father figure.
So you didn't know that you were half Nigerian even when you were young?
No, I didn't, because, as I said, nobody said anything. I gradually started to get confused. Why was I brown skinned and all these other children in the children's home, particularly in the children's home, they were all white. And one day I washed myself 10 times to try and make my face white with red, harsh red carbolic soap. And I ended up in the sick bay because I have very sensitive skin. Now, that tells you straight away I was not comfortable in my skin, literally. I was not comfortable because every so often it would be pointed out to me. I'll give you another story to show the idiocy of it all, to be very honest. In the convent, in the children's home, there was one nun who really liked me. I knew that. I think I was a little bit of a pet for her. And she chose me to, she was putting on this little drama for the children based on nursery rhyme characters. And she, so there was only about half a dozen of us that were included, or maybe 10 of us. And I was one of them. I tell you, I'm a bit of a show off. Oh, I was so happy. And she chose me to be Humpty Dumpty. Another nun came and started arguing with this nun. I'd never seen nuns argue before. That I remember that. The other nun was saying, Elizabeth can't be Humpty Dumpty because she's half caste. Fortunately, the other nun stood her ground and said, she is going to be Humpty Dumpty. And it was back and forth, back and forth. Anyway, she won. I was Humpty Dumpty. And I fell off that wall with such elan. Many, many years later, Miriam, somebody pointed out to me, but Humpty Dumpty was an egg. You can have white eggs, you can have brown eggs, and you can have dark brown eggs. So, and I thought, I wish there's a child. But actually, I don't think I could have said anything because they were quite strict. I think I would have had a bit of a smack if I had dared to intervene into this argument. Yes. So there were examples like that I had.
When and how, especially in the context, and this is something maybe not right away you can come back to if you want, in the context of nursing in the UK, which, if I'm not mistaken, Elizabeth, you're in the realm of nursing, entering into a training, moving up when there are Irish nurses all over the place, presumably, and there are black nurses. You know, it seems to have been quite integrated as a profession. But maybe for you first, where did the instinct come? I mean, how grateful we are that you went into that profession, but when did that, was it something you always wanted to do, or can you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly can. I decided I wanted to be a nurse. I think I must have been around 4 or 5 years of age, and I was in the children's home. It was Nazareth House Children's Home, okay, in Birmingham. The reason was I suffered very badly from eczema, you know, in the armpits, behind the knees. And I would go to the sick bay in the children's home, and I would peep around the door to see which nun was going to do my dressing. The nun I was looking for, in my mind, I called her the white nun. Well, all the nuns were white. But this particular nun wore a white habit rather than the traditional black habit. If it was any of the other nuns, they didn't seem to know how to change my dressings, because I would have applied coal tar paste in those days, lovely cooling paste. Then they'd put gauze on it, because I was very observant. I was watching everything they were doing. And then they would put bandage around it, so my arms and my legs. That was wonderful. However, it was when it came to changing the dressings that I got scared. And that's why I would be looking around the door to see if my favourite nun was going to do it. And it was the nun with the white habit. Because the other nuns, they just used to tear off the bandage, tear off the gauze. The gauze would stick, would have stuck to the coal tar paste, which had stuck to my skin. And the way they took it off, it tore the skin off. And it would be bleeding and painful. And I would be, I can still feel the pain, honestly. The white nun, she would do something different. She would use what we now call distraction therapy. Because what she would do, would she be joking with me? And she'd be using words that I thought were very, very rude. Don't forget, I was in a very religious environment. What was the word? Bottom. As a small child, I thought this was one of the rudest words in the world. And I would burst out laughing. And whilst I was laughing, she would take my dressing off. And I wouldn't feel any pain. And I never wanted to be a nun. No. But I did want to be like this nun. Mm. So when I found out she was a nurse as well as a nun, that's when I decided I wanted to be a nurse. And I never swayed from that decision at all. And it was the best decision I made, I think.
When you went through secondary school, I assume you were pretty academic and I mean, you liked school and everything. And
yes. It was only when I was at secondary school. Now, I was living with my grandparents now. Because of me. And I obviously had been a very upset little soul with all the trauma that I'd had. But I was recovering with my grandparents and wonderful teachers, wonderful teachers. I love reading. And my grandmother wouldn't let me out to go to a youth club. She was very strict. You know, my grandfather had died. It had depressed my grandmother, definitely. And she sort of took it out on me occasionally. But I was a bookworm, so, you know. And I was doing very well at school. And the teachers wanted me to stay on what we call sixth form, yes? So 16 to 18. And they knew that I wanted to be a nurse. Some of the teachers kept telling me, Elizabeth, you're university material. And in those days, when I was at that age, nursing in England was not taught in the universities. It was taught school of nursing attached to a hospital. But I was very obstinate. I said, well, I want to be a nurse. And so they made sure I did the subjects. Looking back, I realised they made sure I was doing the subjects that would get me into university if I changed my mind. And I did get 7 O levels, as they were called then. But, as I said, I knew I wanted to be a nurse. So when I had to leave my grandmother's very suddenly at the age of 16, because apparently that's what she had agreed with my mother. She'd look after me till I was 16. Nobody told me. So that was a big wrench. To suddenly go back to my mother and stepfather. I soon moved out of there and went and worked in a school for residential children, children with heart conditions, severe asthma. And there was a lovely school medical officer of health. I applied to three, what we call teaching hospitals in London. So quite famous hospitals, actually. And I sent on in the application form, they wanted to know the name of your father. I had to leave that blank. In those days, the name of your father and occupation of your father. I had to leave that blank because, yeah, I didn't know. And then you had to send a photograph. So there's a photograph of me. I listed all my qualifications. I never heard back from any of those teaching hospitals. And this school medical officer of health, he was furious with them. He said, anyway, he really was. So he gave me the name of another hospital, and I think he gave me a reference as well. And I got into that hospital, and that's when I started my school. So looking back, I think race could have been a factor in me not, because I had all the educational qualifications. I had more than I needed to get in those days. So what was holding, why wasn't I contacted?
Well,
I don't know, but one can only, you know.
The irony is when you find out later that your father was, what, the first Nigerian ambassador to Italy, how many girls applying had a father of that stature? How then, first of all, for the uninitiated, mm-hmm. what is sickle cell anemia and how did it become such a focus of your work, Elizabeth?
This is where I'm extremely grateful to the United States of America, because I learned so much from coming over, particularly to Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, and Minneapolis in my travels. I came over my holidays and linked in with the sickle cell, the National Sickle Cell Foundation in the US, and they were so helpful. But anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge all the support and help I got from the United States. So sickle cell anemia is an inherited blood disorder that affects the hemoglobin inside the red blood cells. And a child that is born with the illness has to have inherited it from both parents. Those parents don't necessarily have to have sickle cell, the illness, but they must be what's called either a carrier or have the trait. So we take parents, let's say they both have sickle cell trait. They're not affected by it, but every time they conceive a child, there's a 25% chance or 1 in 4 chance that each of their children could be born with sickle cell anemia, for example. Now, the child won't normally have problems until after the age of 6 months, but after that, their red blood cells, this is the child with the illness now, can change from the donut round shape to that resembling a farmer's sickle or a banana shape or a half moon. And they're sticky and they're rigid and they can block in the tiny blood vessels. And this is where the problems can start, from mild to excruciating episodes of pain called the sickle cell painful crisis. They are vulnerable to infections such as pneumonia. There are a variety of problems that can affect virtually every organ of the body, from eyes, causing possible blindness even, problems with the joints, and for example, the hips and the shoulder joint. It's a long-term chronic illness. There's much better treatment available now. There is bone marrow transplantation, which isn't the easiest of treatments, but in the old days you'd say there wasn't a cure, but there's a possible cure. And there's also gene therapy, which again isn't, you know, it's not straightforward to go into that. But there are much better, and there are some new drug treatments that are making the lives of those affected, the quality of their lives have improved. But it is still a long-term condition and still sadly can be fatal, but not in the degree it used to be. And I got interested in it because when I was a health visitor, a public health nurse in London in the early 70s, one of the families that I used to visit had a 9-year-old son with sickle cell anemia. And the mother, who I got on very well with and was able to advise her about nutrition and all sorts of public health issues. However, when she told me that her child had this illness, and she was now asking me, what could she as a mother do to try and keep her child out of hospital so much? And she was happy, reasonably happy with the pediatric care in the hospital, but she couldn't find answers to a lot of the questions that mothers and fathers and carers would ask. And I had to say to her, I can't help you, because I realized I had not been taught about sickle cell anemia in my nursing course or in my public health nursing course. And this was in the late 60s, early 70s in London. Now that made me angry, and I wasn't happy. Why wasn't I taught about this condition when it was a significant issue in cities like London and others? Around the same time, 1972, I found my father, which is a wonderful story in itself. And I then started to meet members of my Nigerian family, both in England, and also I started to go and visit Nigeria on holiday. I then discovered I had a cousin with sickle cell anemia. So it came close to home then. I was interested in it from a professional point of view, a personal point of view, and a political point of view. I call it the three P's. Political with a small p, but I was really angry. Why wasn't this condition taught about? And that's why I got interested. And it was when I came to visit my Nigerian relatives in America that I took the opportunity to visit the National Sickle Cell Charity in the United States. And that's where I got my education about sickle cell in the US, not in England.
Am I correct in thinking, Elizabeth, that sickle cell is more common in people of African descent? That's the political part of it.
So let's go back to sickle cell trait, the parents who are the healthy carriers. Sickle cell trait, if you were living in the tropics where there's malaria, falciparum malaria type, it offers partial protection against malaria in childhood, which is good as an advantage. So wherever you find this malaria, it's not just in parts of Africa, but it's in, for example, in India, the Middle East. That's where you can find sickle cell. And so if you take England, which is my knowledge, the majority of people with sickle cell disease have African Caribbean origin. But there are some white, blue-eyed, blonde individuals with the condition as well. So it's not linked to skin colour. It's linked with historically where this malaria, type of malaria was. But when you get inter-ethnic unions, if you like, let's say, just for example, you could have a black mother and a white father. Or it could be the reverse. Let's say the black parent had sickle cell trait. Healthy, but they could pass the sickle gene onto their child. Just if it's just what from one parent, they can't. That's sickle cell trait. They don't have them. Now you take this child, somebody like myself, I could be carrier because my father could have passed this on to me. It can go down through my generation, however white my generations become. And also remembering that there are white people, for example, it's found in Greece. There are white people who have sickle cell gene. So I think people need to understand why it's more common in certain countries amongst the black populations, such as in England, but that there are non-black individuals. There are white individuals who have the condition. In my country, in England here, that's a minority. The majority are brown, black-skinned individuals. So it's quite confusing for people. They think, I remember when I was a sickle cell counsellor, somebody said, so you have to be black, and the blacker you are, the worse it gets. Is that true? And I said, no, that's not true. So you have to really understand the genetics, the inheritance pattern, as well as the origins of the condition.
That's a great way of explaining it in relation to the malaria aspect. As your life has evolved, Elizabeth, and, you know, you've dedicated so much to improving the lives of others through nursing and your research and publications and advocacy. And you describe very well there your kind of awakening in terms of like tapping into the black side of you as you were finding out it was Nigerian. Did your affinity for Irishness coexist beside that as your life evolved? And I suppose that leads me to a question I want to ask, like, when is it 2016 when you're awarded the damehood?
2017.
Here is this woman, this Nigerian, Irish, English, proud black woman, biracial woman. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? That must have been a surreal experience. How was that experience in the context of your kind of years of work prior to that? If you know, I'm not asking that very well, but you know what I'm trying to get at.
The damehood, but what did you start by asking?
Well, did the Irishness coexist with?
Oh, I see. Yeah. What I've was aware of as my life evolved and I started to link in with both sides of my family and living in London mainly. So I used to say to people, I wasn't born in Ireland. I didn't grow up in Ireland. I wasn't born in Nigeria and I didn't grow up in Nigeria. I was born in Birmingham, England. I've moved around England and did some training in Scotland as well. And I settled for biggest part of my life in London. It was absolutely fantastic, as I've said already, when I got to know both sides of my family and so aware of the love and the obstinacy of my mother and all that she gave up to try and give me a better life, even though it didn't always work out, but she was always trying there. Then when I met my father, obviously, I had to immerse myself in Nigerian culture because I had a lot to catch up on, Miriam, a lot. And, you know, but the similarities between those two cultures, as far as I'm concerned, the sense of humor amongst the Igbo Nigerian, because it's the Igbo ethnic group that my father's family is from. The sense of humor has helped me enormously. When things are getting tough, to see the stupid, silly things in that are going on, that it just helps you. But also, both countries were part of English colonial legacy. Mm-hmm. Because even before I, you know, met my father, and even before I got well and truly aware of the Irish history, because, you know, I started reading about that as a young adult, that's a sort of fusion, that there's, who do you belong to, really? And I realise I'm a right little mixed up person. And it was like I saw it like a pendulum, that the pendulum was over to the Irish side, if you like, because that's all I knew. English, you know, I'm born and brought up in England, but I always remember as a child having that question that often people get asked if they don't look as though by some people they should be there, which was, where are you from, my dear? Now, I ask people where they're from. I don't think that question is a wrong question. And I remember as a small child saying to this lady, I'm from Birmingham, because I had this strong Birmingham accent. I'm from Birmingham. And I remember her wagging her finger like that in front of me. She said, no. Where are you really from? Now, asking me at that age, where am I really from? And all I knew was Birmingham. That made me think, oh, hold on. She doesn't think I'm from here. And I quickly realized this must be due to my skin color. When I met my Nigerian family, obviously I felt that the jigsaw of my identity was now complete. And there's no doubt, Miriam, that in the euphoria of what I was discovering, the pendulum was sort of going up that way towards the African, the Nigerian heritage, because it started to all make sense. But it has swung back. I'm not sure where it is, really. You could say it's in the middle, but it depends on the experiences I'm having in the moment. If I find people are being anti-Irish, up will come my, not quite Fenian, but... because I have studied the Irish, freedom struggle. I have studied that a lot. If I experience a racist encounter due to my skin colour, or if people are being racist about Nigerians, per se, holes, that the Nigerian lion will start to roar. And I just think that's quite, I'm quite comfortable with that. It's not straightforward. I think the most important thing is I'm very comfortable with who I am now, whereas I'm no longer that small child that was scrubbing their face, you know. But I have a great love for the Irish culture, a great love for the Nigerian culture. But I recognise that I was born and brought up in England. So, yeah, I don't know whether that helps answer.
No, it does. But can I ask you a quick follow-up question? You've beautiful photos of your daughter and your granddaughter in Dreams mm-hmm. from My Mother. Do you talk to your, or did you talk to your daughter, or do you talk to your grandmother, sorry, granddaughter, about these influences?
Oh, yes, yes. I remember because my daughter's father was Nigerian. He's deceased now. And we didn't stay together. History repeating itself, probably, but, you know. And I remember her when she was very small. She said to me, "Mummy, I'm half Irish, half Nigerian, and half English." Thought, okay, the math is maybe a little bit, but I like that, you know. And my granddaughter, her heritage is obviously my daughter. Her father is Turkish and English.
Oh, wow.
And she is, it's said grandchildren have quite close relationships with their grandparents quite often, and that's certainly the case. And we're very, very close. She's 14, so her mother is a very good educationist with her daughter. She's aware of current affairs, and it looks like we think she should be a cartoonist because she's got a great sense of humour, and she uses it to draw cartoons about current affairs.
Wow.
So, fingers crossed.
We need more women doing that, and we certainly need more women of colour doing that. That would be lovely.
That's true. That is true, yes.
I wish we had another hour, and I hope that this is the first of other encounters that we have with you in this space. I want to finish off with invoking your mother. She lived long enough to see your professional success, Elizabeth. How did the story end for you in terms of your relationship with her, with this journey that you had to go on? It was a journey that you had to make yourself in terms of your identity. Mm-hmm. And I hope that it finished in a positive way.
Oh, it definitely. My mother died. She was 77 when she died.
Oh, wow.
She died in 2003. She was very, very proud of all my achievements. And in fact, I interviewed a lot of people for my memoirs because I love reading about other people's memoirs and autobiographies. But sometimes when I'm reading certain autobiographies, I'm thinking, you know, the person doesn't come out very well and yet they're lauding themselves as fantastic. And I'm thinking, I wonder what other people might think of you. So I thought I didn't want to fall into that trap myself. So I interviewed 35 people that were family, friends, colleagues. There was a very poignant contribution by my half sister, so from my mother and my stepfather, one of those siblings. And she said that I led the life that Mum should have led. And I thought that I knew she saw me, well, 2003, I had become a professor of nursing by then.
Wow.
So she was very, very proud, you know, of. And the more I learned about what she'd been through, because I discovered more after she died, to be very honest. Some I knew. But she wrote me a couple of letters when I wrote and asked her about her life. So I knew some of it. She was very, very, very proud. Really very proud of me. Yes. Yes.
I can see why. I'm going to bring Kim back on there very shortly, and we're coming close to the end of time, but if anyone has any questions, please don't hesitate to pop them in. We have Philip Tibbs here with us. I don't know, Elizabeth, if you can read that there on the screen. Are you able to see that?
I've just opened it up now. Thank you.
Nice to meet you, former senior healthcare sanitation Terrian, NYC Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, graduate studies at University of Michigan School of Public Health, yes. African-American, Indigenous, Scots-Irish,
wow.
male form of zygote. Thank you for being with us, Phillips. Yes. Phillip, and he's asking a question there.
I met Dr. Linus C. Pauling as an undergrad at the Ohio State University circa 1985 CE. What does CE stand for? Did you ever meet him? No, but wow, gosh, he is so important, isn't he, in the history of conditions such as sickle cell disease. So, wow, you met him, Philip. That's amazing. But no, I never met him. I've just read his works, his papers, and all the scientific contributions he made.
From what you're saying, Elizabeth, I guess because of the population in the United States has been the kind of mecca in terms of research into sickle cell, from what you're saying. Is that right?
Oh, I mean, the history that is mentioned in my memoirs, the history of, I'm fascinated as to how sickle cell disease really got onto the NHI. Have I got it right? NHI, National Health Institute, NIH. Sorry, I need my acronym. So that how sickle cell well and truly got onto the agenda of the National Institutes of Health agenda. That's an amazing story. And I learned a lot from, I've always thought we were 30 years behind the United States, but you have to have influencers, you have to have people. And the story that I found incredible was, there was a mother of a child with sickle cell anemia who wrote to NIH complaining about the lack of support for her and her child. And it landed on the desk of this gentleman in NIH, if I'm right, whose father ran a television network station in Washington, D.C. And he got talking to his father. And as a result, the first major fundraising event for sickle cell disease in Washington was organized, and that raised the profile. Others will know the story better than I, but I learned a lot of lessons from how the struggle to get sickle cell on the agenda. And I'm also watching how, right here, we're having to fight to get it back on the agenda because of a variety of issues. And it's not just because of the COVID pandemic, but, you know, We can't be complacent, particularly for minority health issues. Other issues will nudge them off the agenda if we're not complacent. I'm really sorry, but doing stuff at home, my doorbell is going.
Well, listen, we better end there. No, we're right on time. I just want to thank you, Kim, for being here with us again today for this. Thank you so much.
I'm going to wave you bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.